Hello, this is Don Victor, author of Drawn to Win, host of the podcast Drawn to Win, the director of the Academy of Composition, and the creator of the Core 80 Experience, also known as the See and Grow Rich in Art video course, which you can find out more information at core80.com. This is the Drawn to Win podcast, where I have the incredible privilege to draw artists from around the world into fun and meaningful conversations around art and life, and yes, maybe even a little food. You can hear us each week on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and YouTube. So make sure you subscribe so you always have a seat among friends. Let's get into the show. Eugene, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Victor.
I came across you. I was in one of those online groups on Facebook, and I was actually really surprised because it was really a group of very, very serious artists, and which was really nice to see. And so, you know, then we had a conversation, and I went over and saw your work, and I was like, okay, man, this. We gotta have you on the show. So I thank you for taking my invite and coming on.
Glad to be here.
So, Eugene, what's going on with you in your studio right now?
Well, usually the way I've been doing things the past maybe 3 years or so is that I usually plan out a project that I would probably take anywhere from 6 months to maybe 14 months to complete. And these are usually lengthy projects that I plan everything out from the beginning stages. And then I paint it. The technique that I use is most closely related to the old Dutch technique, the Dutch masters that they used. I mean, you know, every single Dutch master had their own technique that they used, but that's the kind of spirit that I'm trying to emulate in my technique. Mm-hmm. It's not exactly like any precise Dutch master, but that's what I'm going for. And that's why these projects take me so long to complete, because I try to make them appear to look good, not just from far away, but from up close as well. So mm-hmm. my mission is to make them look three-dimensional and refined from any distance that you look at the project.
Nice. And when you say the Dutch, are you... Do you work in like, do you do like a grayscale painting and then like glaze on top of it, or what are you pulling from the Dutch artists?
It's mostly the rendering that I do of the painting that's closely okay. More close related to the Dutch.
I gotcha. That's neat. That's neat. What Dutch artists are kind of like some of your heroes?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, this is probably very typical of me to say, because most people love this artist. Probably their favorite artist is Rembrandt. Mm-hmm. That's really my hero. I just love the breadth of his work all throughout everything that he did. In my opinion, he's the greatest portraitist of all time. He's also an incredible scenery painter. And he's a great etcher, great composer. Everything about him is just phenomenal. There's also other lesser artists. I wouldn't say lesser, but lesser known. Mm-hmm. Like Jan Steen, who did very genre scenes of, everyday life in Holland during that time. In general, when I go to a museum, I love to look at different periods of realism. And I love to go to the Italian section and see Italian Baroque and Renaissance paintings. Mm-hmm. But what I really, when I go to a museum, what I really like to do most of everything is go to the Dutch Baroque section and really see works by Rembrandt and students of Rembrandt, the Circle, and artists that did work in Holland during the 1700s. I mean, I'm sorry, 1600s, 17th century is what I meant to say. Yep.
That's really cool. And you've been to Holland and Antwerp and those places?
Have I been to Holland? No, not yet. I want to go. I want to go to Holland. I want to visit the Rijksmuseum, which is the number one destination for me, to see all the great Dutch traditional work.
Now, I think you've been to Italy before, correct?
Yes, I just came back from Italy. I was in Italy October 2017.
Oh, wow, so not too long ago. That's awesome. That's awesome. And what was that experience like for you?
Oh, it was really it was phenomenal. I mean, for me, I'm saying that I like to try to emulate the technique of the Dutch masters in my work, but for me, Italy is really the foundation, it's the mother of Western art, because I consider, you know, the Italian Renaissance and Baroque artists to really be probably the greatest artists of all time, such as Michelangelo and Titian, Bernini, Raphael, Caravaggio. And my main objective when I went to Italy, which is really the number one thing that I've always wanted to go to Italy for, was to view as many Michelangelo pieces as I possibly could, because he's really my favorite artist ever. And he's the reason why I started to do art in the first place. When I saw some of his works, such as David and Pieta and Sistine Chapel and other works, I was just so amazed at the quality of the work, especially David. The statue of David really just blew me away. I was so impressed by it. Have you ever seen the statue of David in real life?
No.
Oh, I highly recommend you visit the Accademia Galleria at Florence and really spend some time with David, because, you know, before that I've seen replicas. I've seen the one at Caesar Palace in Vegas, and there's another one here in Glendale in the Forest Lawn Cemetery. And the replicas, what they usually do is they can replicate the form of David, but what makes the actual original so special is the way Michelangelo treated the texture of the sculpture, because I've walked around it for about an hour and a half, just taking photographs from every angle and analyzing textures on different parts of the skin, and he really treated each part of the skin of David as if that's the kind of texture there should be on that part of the skin. Like, for instance, the heel of the left foot of David, it has texture on it like any person would have texture on the heel, like callus that's forming from walking. And it's just phenomenal. I mean, he really took it to that extent. And that's what replicators cannot do. They can't replicate the precise texture that Michelangelo was able to employ in his sculptures.
That's fascinating, man. That's fascinating. Wow.
Yeah, he's everybody that knows me and knows about my views on art, they all are tired of hearing this, but I have to say this. I mean, this is just, in my opinion, that's absolute truth, is that Michelangelo is just by far the greatest artist of all time. For me, at least, you know, and for his contributions in all the three disciplines, which is sculpture, painting, and architecture.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to accomplish such heights in each one. I have about 5 or 6 Michelangelo books, mm-hmm. 5 of his sculpture work, and I think 1 of his drawings. And I look through them from time to time just to look at the work. And every time I look at the work, I'm just so impressed with the quality of it in every single way. Mm-hmm. I mean, the guy was just super, super human.
He was super human. It's interesting you say that those three disciplines. I know there's a famous Michelangelo quote where he says, design, or the science of line drawing, if you want to call it that, is the very soul and essence of architecture, painting, and sculpture. And, as an architect, sculptor, and painter, it was incredible. But as a designer and a composer of all those things, it's really the mind behind all of the sculpture and the design. I mean, sculpture, painting, and architecture is his ability to design incredible. These things.
You're absolutely right. You're spot on 100%. Because that's what I tell people when they ask me about Michelangelo's work. And I say he was incredible at everything that he did. But his biggest strength in his art was his understanding of design.
Mm-hmm.
That's really something that made him who he was, is that he had this divine understanding of design. Just to an extent that nobody, in my opinion, really got it to that extent. His work, his sculptures, the way I see the Renaissance compared to the Baroque, can I just explain this part? Is that the Renaissance, up until High Renaissance, they were trying to find the absolute perfection for the form of painting and sculpture,
mm-hmm.
and they were trying to find the perfect design for things. And at the end of the Renaissance, the High Renaissance, is when they really achieved that in some of the works, like Leonardo's Mona Lisa, or Michelangelo's David and Pietà. They really, really got to the perfection of the design in those pieces. And the Baroque is something that they realized that we already achieved from the previous artists before us the perfection in these mediums. So now we're going to go off and try to do something more ambiguous and more complex. But the way I see it is that I favor Renaissance design more than any other period, because they really got to the pinnacle of perfection in their designs with these great artists. I mean, I think the School of Athens by Raphael is an incredible composition.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much, there's so much about it that's just so profound. One of the things I'll say is that, there's Plato and then there's Aristotle in the center of the painting, and
mm-hmm.
I'm just visualizing it in my head right now. I kind of see it in my head, and on the right there's Aristotle, and on the left there's Plato. Plato's pointing up at the sky, and his whole philosophy is that about the soul and about the about the higher being of consciousness, mm-hmm. and Aristotle is more earthbound. So on the side of Aristotle, there's people that are more towards philosophy of Aristotle. On the side of Plato, there's people that are more in the philosophy of Plato. And also the way the clothes that Raphael chose for each one represents Let me just take a look at it real quick.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the clothes. Is actually very symbolic for each one, and basically Plato. And by the way, Raphael displayed Plato as a model. He used Leonardo da Vinci for the model of Plato.
Ah, very cool. That's cool.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting little fact. he used a lot of contemporaries in this piece. And Plato is actually in red and violet.
Mm-hmm.
So this represents things that cannot be measured, such as red, fire, and violet is air. So those are the qualities of Plato that Raphael chose symbolically to represent in his clothing. Aristotle, however, is in blue and brown.
Mm-hmm.
And the blue represents water and the brown represents earth. So it's something that can be measured. So it's more earthbound.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
It's just really, there's so much about this composition that can be analyzed. It's really just so profound. And everything here is symbolic mm-hmm. that Raphael chose to represent. And it's really amazing. So the Renaissance artists like Raphael and Leonardo, Michelangelo, they really thought about every single thing that they did in their work that made it so profound in its design. And that's what I wanted to get at.
Yeah, I love it. I'm looking at it now as well. I brought it up, and you know, it's interesting because it's almost like when you look at it, it's so symmetrical. And it's there's this symmetry to it, which makes you question, like, which side do you belong on? And ultimately, you may end up walking away saying you don't pick a side. It's just the completion, you know. So you have the four elements. You have one pointing up, one pointing down. And so to be complete human, you need to be able to think like, you know, Aristotle, and you need to be able to think like the Plato, you know, side of it. Because it's so well balanced, it's like there is no clear quote unquote winner. You know, it's just who we are as humans. That's really cool, man. I always find it very, very fun when reading art and analyzing the designs in them. And one of the things I noticed in terms of design between the Baroque and the Renaissance is that a lot of times the design work on the Renaissance was within, you know, what I'll call this two-dimensional surface. And so the designs that they're drawing and they're connecting things are really just connecting the top to the bottom, the right side to the left side. And then in Baroque, it's like they add, if you think of it as a sphere, where Renaissance design is much more, let's say, a circle. It's two-dimensional shape working with inside there. But then you get into this Baroque, and it's like they add this whole third dimension to it, which is just kind of like this space that brings you in. And so they're not only designing the top and the bottom or the sides, but they're actually designing the depth, and not only into the piece, but actually out from the piece too. And so, like, depending on where you stand, you'll have a very different experience, because you're actually at one point not in the painting or in the design. And then if you just step, you know, 1 foot to the left or whatever, now you're in the design, and now you're actually part of this experience, this dynamic, this moment. And it's
right. Yeah, you know, absolutely. And, you know, I just posted maybe a week ago or something about Velazquez's masterpiece, Las Meninas. And I think that's just a profound composition. You know, there's so much about it that's just so incredible.
Mm.
And there's been books written about just that painting alone. What you're saying is absolutely right. It applies to a lot of Baroque art. And Las Meninas, I think, is really one of the ultimate compositions in Baroque. Like, there are certain parts of it that just makes you question reality. Like, for instance, you know, you see the mirror in the back that's supposed to reflect the king and the queen.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody in the painting, you know, there's the little princess, and then there's the two dwarves. One of them is looking out at the plane of where the viewer is. And there's people that are noticing something. And it makes you think, well, they're noticing the king and the queen that are standing there that Velázquez is painting at the time. But the mirror itself is supposed to be reflecting the surface of the painting that he's working on. And it kind of makes you question, what are we seeing in the mirror? Is it the reflection of the painting that Velázquez is working on? Or is it the reflection of the king and the queen that's standing in front of these figures that Velázquez is painting at the moment and these people are noticing at the moment? And it kind of makes you question the reality of this scene, of this mirror, also with the fact that from such a distance that Velázquez is painting the king and the queen, if they were standing there, they would even be smaller. There would be a small reflection in the mirror of the king and the queen.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole concept makes you question different levels of reality that are going on. What's real? What are we seeing in the mirror? Are we seeing the reflection, or are we seeing the reflection of a painting inside the painting?
Mm-hmm.
So it's really something that can be analyzed in so many different ways. And in general, this painting is about the high art form of painting, of what painting can do. And another thing that I noticed, which is very interesting, is that for a long time, there was this emphasis on which figure is the tallest in the composition is the one that has the most value, the most significance. So mm-hmm. in this composition, Velázquez made himself the tallest figure out of everybody, even mm-hmm. taller than the reflection of the king and the queen. But that's also kind of an illusion, because if the king and the queen are standing in front of the painting, then they would be taller than Velázquez by default.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an interesting kind of juxtaposition that we're seeing here.
And then to push it even just a little bit further, the fact that you and I are looking at this painting, he then transports us through the eyes of the king and queen, making the everyday person, the anyone who has eyes to see this painting, now become king and queen.
Yeah, it's just really amazing.
And in a feudal system, like, you know, we don't live in a feudal system, so that's like, yeah, okay, that's cool. But then, you know, to give people the experience of what it would be like in a moment to look through the life, to see in not just what the king and queen have, but actually to see their life through their eyes, is probably a very revolutionary thing. You know, almost like who that's a very interesting painting. Yeah, that's interesting. Very interesting.
I think that Diego Velázquez is really like what we were just talking about, what made Michelangelo such a great artist.
Yep.
Was we both agreed his sense of design. And Velázquez is really his biggest strength, among all these other things that he was incredible at, but his sense of design and composition is his work really is just has a very strong sense of design in it. Yeah. Even his great canvas, The Surrender of Breda, which is, I'm going to bring it up right now. And it's really interesting because this is actually a propaganda piece for the time. And it shows the Flemish, I believe it's the Flemish that surrendered to the Spanish. There was a war going on between them. And on the left side, they show the Flemish that are kind of, you know, they show the their weapons kind of disorganized, mm-hmm. kind of, you know, manner where it's like one is pointing another way, the other one's pointing another way. It's not really even. On the left, on the right side, it's the Spanish, and it showed the spears being almost parallel to one another, every single yep. one. Yep. So it shows order, it shows logic from their side. Mm-hmm. Also, it shows the Spanish as sort of, you know, conquerors that are very grateful to the Flemish for surrendering. And it's a very interesting piece, even though this wasn't the reality of the time. This is far from what happened during that time. But like I mentioned earlier, this is a propaganda piece for the Spanish court. And I just think it's really beautifully done. But speaking of propaganda, I'm not really saying this in a negative way, because I don't really think that this is a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that most Renaissance and Baroque art was religious propaganda, but from that propaganda, there came the greatest art of all time, which is the artist that we now revere as almost godlike, like Michelangelo and, you know, Bernini and all these other artists. And by the way, these artists actually believed in what they were doing.
It wasn't propaganda in the way of, hey, let's con you into believing something, right?
Yeah, it wasn't like that.
But at the same time, it's propaganda because it's being commissioned by a higher authority, aka the church or the government or rich families, banks, whatever, and it's being then given to the masses at some level. So at that level, it's propaganda because they're trying to effectively communicate a concept, an idea, quote unquote, history, be it true or not. I don't think, you know, no one ought to get offended because you're saying propaganda, because that's what it is. It's not necessarily negative.
I didn't mean it in a condescending way.
Yeah.
But you know, if you want to look at it historically, that's really what it was for the time, because the Catholic Church was trying to gain more support, mm-hmm. more power, especially during the Counter-Reformation. Michelangelo actually was a very religious person. He was mm-hmm. extremely religious. And I actually saw a documentary about him. He was very concerned towards the end of his life of where his soul would end up after he would die. And he had a correspondence with the cardinals, and he would write to them about that. And they said, you know what? If you work for us, you'll get into heaven. But Michelangelo was smarter than that. He didn't really exactly. believe that. And, you know, he questioned that. He was very concerned about his soul. So it wasn't like he was creating things to lie to other people with, you know, his religious work. He was really was a very religious person. He believed in what he was doing. But again, it was commissioned by the higher authority to reflect their views on the public, on the masses.
And Bernini was the same way. His faith was extremely powerful. Caravaggio, on the other hand, wasn't what they would call a believer. And it's very interesting if you look at their work. I do a little talk on Caravaggio and Bernini and the role of faith and religion in their life and how it affects their artwork, where if you look at a Caravaggio, when he tries to represent the presence of this divine, it's always represented in an external source of light shining onto you from afar, onto you or from above or whatever. But it's usually seen as the presence of a light coming onto the form. Where Bernini, you know, he'll have the presence of the divine represented in an expression of ecstasy, almost even an orgasm, right? So it's this concept that the divine is real, but it's within you, and it comes out. It doesn't come onto you. It comes out of you. And then having two great masters produce incredible artwork, but from two different realities, where one's more of an intellectual type of approach and one's much more of an experiential approach. very, very fascinating stuff to look at. But that's really cool, man.
Yeah. No, you're right. Yeah.
I'm just looking at this painting here. I do like all the spears. It's kind of like a whole bunch of guys there, and they're like, our spears are straighter, longer, and more vertical than yours.
Yeah.
Not saying anything. but that's pretty funny. Yeah, beautiful, man. Beautiful. It's always fun. You know, it's interesting when you study it from a design perspective, which is what I do, because I don't consider myself a painter. Not that I can't defend myself and paint, but I don't consider myself a painter. And so therefore, I don't analyze art from the perspective of a painter. I primarily analyze art from the perspective of storytelling and design. And Michelangelo was an incredible designer and storyteller. But when you look at it from the design perspective, it carries through and it holds up. And there's a lot of artists. I think Renoir was an incredible designer and storyteller. And then you have people like Sargent, of course. And then they even go up into your modern illustrators like Rockwell and Wyeth and those guys. But what connects them all is that they were designers. I think Degas said, I read in one book, I think it was The Secret Geometry of Painters, where Degas said something along the lines of, there are better painters than I, but because I remember I'm a draftsman first, aka a designer, as well as someone who can draw, but primarily talking about composition and design, I will be the one that they remember. And it was just, you know, I don't know if he was an arrogant guy or if he just understood, like, the longevity of your art is actually embedded in the design. And in this case, not necessarily in the paint, per se. Very interesting way of looking at
that. I think you have a very good point. Actually, I'll speak from my experience, is that I have three design degrees, two mm-hmm. in graphic design and one in web design. Mm. And after I completed my degrees, I've actually looked at art in a much different way, because I would never do some of the things that I've done in my art if I didn't study design in depth the way I have in art school. Mm. Like, for instance, I'll bring up a point. I did the Holocaust painting in 2016, mm-hmm. and I did it from an old 1940s photograph that's practically pixelated. I mean, it's really just almost, you can't really see any details, but I put in as much detail and knowledge as I could. I actually had models pose for the hands and things like that. And for the stars, it's all a grayscale image. And for the stars, I chose to do it yellow stars, which is mm-hmm. During the Holocaust, they gave yellow stars to the Jewish prisoners. And if I haven't done that, if I didn't put the yellow stars in the painting, it wouldn't read at all. I mean, it would just be a mess. It would just be a mess of figures put together, just stacked together. But what makes this painting read is that element of design that I put in the composition, which is made the stars yellow. Mm-hmm. It's just a small difference like that made all the difference in the painting. And I'm glad I did that. So it's it's certain things like that, that certain touches that make the painting stand out and read much better, mm-hmm. opposed to it being just all monochromatic. Actually, I don't know if you've heard of this artist. I've studied from 2010 to 2014 with a great Russian artist. His name is Leonid Steele, and he died in 2014. And he was actually a very close friend of mine. Yeah, I studied with him.
That's awesome. I did an analysis of his painting. I asked his son, Alexei.
I know Alexei.
Yeah, I asked him if he had an artist he wanted me to do an analysis of, and he threw me a curveball, and he gave me the painting of his dad. Now, I didn't know anything about Russia or the Ukraine or those kinds of places, and I studied it. I did about an hour and a half lecture on it. Not lecture, but, where I broke it down, and I broke down the composition, the design. What was funny was in that painting, by Alexei's dad, in the design, it kept coming back to this woman sitting on a cart with this little baby. And,
what is the painting?
It's the one with the far, where the community comes out and they're, the guy has his hand on the ground, like, and he's basically saying
it's called The Land.
I've
seen it many times when I went over his house.
Wow,
it's actually still hanging there. It's a giant canvas. It's
awesome.
Phenomenal. I think it took him 12 years to do that one.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, it's a really a grand painting. It's really a phenomenal piece. I've been always admiring it. Every time I went to his house, he would always show me some new work that he would do. And I was so impressed because, he was such a great artist. And also, he was a good friend of mine. He wasn't, just directing me or telling me, criticizing my work, because that's what I would do. I would bring my work over, he would criticize it, and then I would keep working. But he was also a very... really nice guy. I mean, I would have these conversations with him about, his life, because he was a World War II veteran.
Mm.
And he would tell me about the war, and, he would also tell me these really interesting things, like, he knew these very famous Russian people back in USSR. He knew, the composer Dmitri Shostakovich.
Okay.
He actually painted a portrait of the famous Russian violinist David Oistrakh. He knew the very first astronaut in space, Yuri Gagarin. So it's really fascinating to hear this man talk. And he actually told me that one of his professors in college or art school, where he went to, I think, Repin Academy, that's where he graduated from, was a student of the famous Russian painter Isaac Levithan. And if you look at Leonid's landscapes, because he's done thousands of paintings in his life, he's done maybe close to 5,000 paintings. And I don't know if you've ever seen his landscapes, but I recommend you go online and take a look at his landscape work. It's just phenomenal. I mean, he was such an amazing landscape painter as well. Everything that he did was just so amazing, and the landscapes are just like, you look at a Levithan and you see Leonid and you almost can't tell the difference of who's who, I mean he was that good. This guy was a genius. Afterwards I copied some of his academic drawings, and it's just a real pleasure studying his work. And in general, I really do miss him. Like I said, he wasn't just a mentor of mine. He was also a very good friend of mine, and just a really great guy, really great person.
That's awesome, man. That's awesome. That's really beautiful. When we're done here, what I'll do is I'll find that video and I'll send it to you that I did of that painting, The Land. And I think you'll get a lot out of it. You'll enjoy it.
Great. Perfect.
And Alexi wrote a whole, almost like a little book on it on Facebook, based on the video. And what was interesting was that the little baby that the design, at least from the way I was reading it, kept coming back to, happened to be Alexi when he was 10 months old. He was the model of that little. So, it was kind of funny. Beautiful man. I saw pictures of him, and he just looked like one of those cool old school teachers that you just wanted to like just sit and listen, and he could probably tell you stories and stories about things.
You know, I'll tell you this, is that I believe that Leonid was a genius. Mm-hmm. You know, I think he was an art genius for sure. And like most art geniuses, you know, he was in his 90s. I think he was 92 when he passed away. And I've socialized with him until the end. And every time I came over his house, it was like I'm talking to somebody that's very young, a young mm-hmm. person, a young soul, almost almost childlike, not childlike in the immature in a mental way.
Yeah,
very, mm-hmm. Very young person. It was so refreshing to talk to him. Like, you know, he wasn't like, you know, there's people that become old and they become bitter. He was very young and very full of life. You know, it was so refreshing to talk to them, to him, every time I came over. And, you know, I wish you would have gotten to meet him, because you know, it would have been, I think you would be very pleased if you met this man. He was just a phenomenal person in every single way. And a really, like I said, really nice guy. I
mean, yeah.
Just genuinely a really good person.
I could tell from his painting a lot about the soul of the man, that he really cared about people. He was very aware of what was under the surface of things. I could tell that he could really understand the nature of individuals, you know, and know their stories. And I've never met him. I've just spent so many years studying design, the designs on their compositions. And I understand like it's very weird. The designs are really the inner thoughts of the artist. And when you can read it, it's almost crazy, because you in a way you feel like you're actually stepping inside the flesh of that artist and seeing and even feeling the mind working. Because you know, when you're drawing or whatever, and then drawing is interesting because you're kind of observing and copying at some sense. But when you're designing, now you're making decisions on what you're going to edit, what you're going to emphasize, why this starts here, why it ends there, why it's in this direction. Is it a Baroque, a sinister, you know, reciprocal, a rebated, all kinds of, you know, all these different things that go into ordering these lines and spaces and values. And then to do it in such a way that if you're trying to communicate something, that every single thing, and even Alexi was saying that his dad would just constantly, he probably did this with you too, just constantly was obsessed with the composition, you know. And just...
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, it's like it's. I mean, I know that the Russian school in general is very. They're very focused on composition.
Yep.
Because, you know, I've had mentors throughout my life that were also Russian. They always kept telling me, you know, you gotta study composition.
Yep.
Because that's the number one most important thing in painting, and is if the wireframe of the composition is not making any sense, if it's just off, then there's no point of even doing the painting itself. I mean, everything has to work. Composition is really the foundation of the painting. If there's no composition, then there will be no painting.
That's right. And, you know, it's interesting. I've met a few Russian artists. I talked to this one Russian girl, and I may be wrong in saying this, but basically in the essence of what I'm saying is true. She was saying there were like either four or five, like in a 4-year education, you took drawing, you took painting, there was another class you took, but also you took a composition class in Russia, and you had 4 years of composition, where in most art schools, in at least in the United States or outside of, let's say, Russia, you know, say Europe, United States, you might have quote unquote composition class, maybe two classes or so, like in some two-dimensional design curriculum. But like, there really is no design composition class. And when they do teach design, it's much more like a graphic design type of thinking. But they don't really show you or teach you how, you know, for example, like repetition, right? You'll go into one of these design classes and they'll make you cut out paper and repeat patterns, but they'll never bridge the gap for the illustrator or the fine artist on why repetition is important in a work of art, you know? And so, you know, like when I'm working with a student, I'll say, if I tell you to get up and go to the left, or get up and go to the right, or get up and jump up and down, or get up and sit down, you'll get confused because you don't know what I'm saying. But if I say, get up and go to the right, 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 it becomes very, very clear what I'm communicating. And that's the importance of one of the importance of repetition. And so and that was one of my beefs with, I actually got in trouble when I was in college because I wrote a big letter about my 2D design teacher and how just this was useless and you're taking the money of these students because they're not learning design. Yeah. And she didn't like that. Yeah, very cool. So,
well, I also mm-hmm. think that, you know, an artist can learn composition their entire lives. Mm-hmm. I don't think a 4-year program is really going to, you know, you're going to learn everything there is about composition in 4 years, because there are certain things in composition where they might have not even been done before, and you do it and it works, and that's how it came out to be. I mean, it's really an open-ended thing. You can know the basics of composition, basics of design, but when it comes down to the practice of composing a painting, there's a lot of things that you can do. There's also, there's a term in Italian called pentimenti, and that's when, I'll just explain it for the people mm-hmm, who listen mm-hmm. to this, is when a painter does, let's say, they paint a figure in the background, and they mm-hmm. paint the head leaning to the left, and then they realize, no, that's wrong. It doesn't look right. It doesn't go with the design. So they do it leaning towards right. They paint over it. And mm-hmm. that's the change that they made to the painting. And a lot of old masters used to do that in their work. And I think that composition is something that maybe somebody might be able to grasp after much experience, after, you know, hundreds of drawings and paintings. And you'll be able to understand it to a certain extent. But I don't really believe that somebody can just learn everything there is to know about composition in 4 years, because it's something that you can learn your entire life. You can explore your entire life. And it's something that's it's like problem solving, you know, mm-hmm, that's how I see composition. It's like problem solving in visual ways.
Mm-hmm. That's a really great example. You know, one of the things I deal with my students is, well, I had this one student, and she's in Australia, and she would have these incredible rendered paintings. I mean, she, you know, would paint like a photograph. Like, it was, her skill was incredible. But I realized, like, when I would ask her, hey, so what's the point of this piece? And she would begin to explain it. And we went through piece after piece after piece. And I realized that she wanted the paintings to be open and welcoming. But she painted all of these paintings on what they would call a sinister diagonal, which means that the, you could say in terms of the head, it was leaning to the left, right? Which is a sinister. In Italian, it means left. And then you have the opposite angle, which leans to the right, which is called a Baroque. And the Baroque, because of the way we read and the way our eye works with the image, with the rectangle, it actually, when you bring somebody in on the right angle, on that right angle, in that Baroque angle, it allows them to actually read and take in much more information within the whole piece. And so they feel that they have permission and that they're actually welcomed into the image. But if you do it on the sinister, it takes you from the top left hand, like where you're going to start reading, all the way to the bottom right so quickly that you feel like you're missing something. And so therefore it triggers with inside the viewer this sense of like, this is a secret issue. Like maybe I shouldn't be looking at this. There's something hidden, you know, and it's weird. It works. I would say almost 100% of the time, just by flipping those two angles, you can totally trigger a very different emotion. And so with her, she was wanting to welcome people in, but the image was were designed in such a way that it actually, on a subconscious level, told them to stay out. And and so we changed that right away. and so it's what's nice with computers now, you can throw something in there and just, you know, in 2 seconds, just flip it. And all of a sudden it has a totally different feel. And you're like, oh my God, that's it. You know? And for some reason, a lot of times, and it's a very common thing. It's like, when a lot of students come to me, it's like they're drawing backwards. And I don't know if it's because of the way the eye is or whatever, or maybe because of, you know, the angle in which they're looking at the drawing versus like how somebody else would look at it. So it's but that's one of the big issues. So I agree that like in anything, you can spend a lifetime learning and developing it. But I would push back a little bit on the idea, and maybe even a lot of it. I do believe that there is a science to design and composition that really hasn't been taught in about the last 100 years within Western culture. And in Russian culture is very different because they didn't allow the expressive, like the abstract expressionist movement to come in and contaminate the art. And so therefore composition, that kind of thing was preserved. It wasn't contaminated. But a lot of the other parts of the world, especially the United States and parts of Europe, it got bastardized and even, I believe, intentionally removed from art education. And so a lot of times they sent people out and just said, hey, you know, express whatever you want. Chaos is our friend, you know. And right, you don't right. need that design stuff. You know, that's old school. It's old traditional, you know. Be free, be chaotic, evolve something nice, you know, and you do that for two, three generations, and all of a sudden you just have a bunch of lost people who are sincere about their art. They just don't have the right foundation, the composition and the design. So it's one of my missions in this life to help bring that understanding back to the common language and also the common education for artists. And but I'm happy that you got to spend time with the mentors that you've had, and you were able to see the importance of that and spend time in there. It's really cool.
Thank you. And I just want to say, going back to Russian art, is I mean, I'm sure that everybody is going to know who this artist is when I say his name. But Ilya Repin, the great Russian artist, was also a great composer. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, his work is very precisely, intentionally composed, every single element in his work. Let me just bring an example. His famous painting that really put him on a map, which is Barge Haulers on the Volga. You know, you see these peasants that are moving the ship. Yes. And it's very hard work. They're pulling the ship forward. And you see how miserable they are, how dirty they are. And that's going on. But there's a little tiny thing that only if you look closely at the painting, you notice. And it's a social commentary painting. And if you look, I believe on the, I'm just visualizing in my head, but if you look to the right of the painting, you see a little steamboat in the background.
Interesting.
So he says that during that time there was steam. You could have pulled that ship with steam power
mm-hmm.
towards to haul it to the dock, but instead you use the cheaper method, which is hire these peasants, and you don't care about their health, about their hard work that they're putting into. You'd rather use them to do this excruciating work and pay a little less and save a little money than use the steam power. So mm-hmm. that was sort of a social commentary for that time of, lower classes being exploited in that area.
Absolutely.
So it's just, you know, it's even little things like that. And Leonid once told me, and it stuck with me forever, and he said, art is built on subtleties.
Mm-hmm.
There can be a subtle little change in something, and that's going to change the whole piece. It's going to mm-hmm. change, you know, it's going to change the whole meaning of the piece. There can be a little change in something, and, you know, that can do it. That little change can make all the difference.
Yep.
And you're right. I mean, that's the way you got to think about these things in design and composition, is that, I mean, even the smallest things make a big impact.
Yep. Yep. In the Asian art, they'll call it the dragon's eye. It might be a color. In this case, it's not a color, but it's actually the steamboat right in the background. And when you look at the size of that steamboat compared to the size of the painting, I mean, it's like strange. It's like this little shell or whatever on the ground in the front foreground. It's almost the same size. But it's just sometimes it's a little tiny thing, but in Asian art, you know, it might be adding a little red to this, you know, maybe a little red orange to this beautiful blue green, image, right? And it just activates it, like turns on the image, and it's just boom, and then it's done. Yeah. And now, counteracting that, sometimes it can be a little thing that destroys a painting. For example, how many times have you seen a beautiful painting, and then as you got closer, it just gets destroyed because the signature is either way too dark or the placement of it is just in some weird place, and it just violates and competes with all of the other elements because it wasn't actually composed or designed into the image. It was kind of just like a sticker put on a painting. And sometimes it's big, but it can be small, but and still ruin a piece. It becomes almost like graffiti on a painting.
I understand mm-hmm. what you mean. I'll speak from my experience. Like mm-hmm. for instance, the painting I just finished that got the best of show in the international competition Colors of Humanity. It's the Motherly Love painting,
mm-hmm. and congratulations.
It's about. Thank you so much. Thank you. It's about a mother and a newborn child and the older brother welcoming a new member of the family. And actually, I signed it a little bigger than I usually would, even though it's not a big painting. It's not a big signature at all, but I signed it a little bigger. And I also signed it with the color of the skin tones of the people in the painting, because the skin of the painting, the skin tones of the people are kind of warm in color, opposed to the cool surrounding, the cool fabric and things like that. So it shows life among inanimate objects. But I signed it with the tone of the skin, with a concept that I felt intimacy with the scene that I, when I was painting it, and I put myself into it. It really was a very intimate project for me. And I signed it a little bigger because of that, because I wanted to emphasize that concept. Even though maybe some people might look at it and say, well, you know, the signature is a little too big, or, you know, but I actually did that intentionally because I wanted to give it more significance. I wanted to give my signature more significance. So even my signature in that painting has a concept relating to those figures in the painting. And it's very symbolic that I did that. It wasn't just an accident. So I understand what you mean. And I actually thought about, before putting the signature, of how I was going to do it. And that's the way I did it. And that's the way it came out. I don't know if, you know, people are going to like it or not. I mean, you know, certainly there, it wasn't an accident that I did my signature that way. Sometimes, of course, when you do a painting, it's best for most people to just do a signature in a very neutral color that it doesn't pop out at the eye. Like, for instance, don't make the signature bright red or green or things like that. You know, probably something that's more neutral is the way to go. But with this painting that I just completed, I actually thought of it even more in depth of the color I was going to use for the signature and the placement and the size of the signature. So that's what I did.
Now, is that painting? Do you know the people in that painting?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
It's a friend of mine from back in the day. I still talk to her from time to time. She actually has three kids now. Three beautiful kids in the family, and you know, she's very happy for me that you know, I've got success with this painting. It's actually the third time I'm doing this composition, and I wasn't happy with it the first few times, because I just kind of, you know, I did what I tried to do with them, but I wasn't happy with them. And then I decided, you know, I want to do it one last time. And that's when I did it. And, you know, I'm more so content with it now.
Nice, 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 very nice. I was looking at it and there I like the big brother. There was this really neat thing in terms of design that was going on, and you had the pink of the face, and then you had this blue of the gown that the mother's in, and it's kind of in his face, and obviously it gives you a nice light on dark contrast, so you can see the silhouette of the little boy. But it also, interestingly enough, it creates this cup. Like this slight curve that almost makes the boy feel like he's trying to push into this little space, where it's like he wants to be there, and at the same time it makes me feel like he's uncertain if he's allowed to be there, you know, like too close to the little guy. But at the same time you feel like he wants to be there, right? And I was like, ooh, that's a pretty cool strategy, you know, to use maybe in something else.
Yeah, he's a little cautious. Cautious, and
yeah, and it was. So that was cool, very cool. So Eugene, how did you get started in art? You know, we spent most of the time talking kind of about ideas and more current, where you are currently, but like, you know, did you start when you were like, you know, like a half a month old and you found a pencil laying on a rock somewhere and working? Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you the story. And this actually goes back to Michelangelo, which is the reason why I started to do art in the first place. When I was about 3 or 4 years old, it was in Ukraine, and my dad took out a book, and he just, for some reason, he just decided to show me the black and white image, the grayscale image in that book. And it was the image of Statue of David. And I saw it, and I was a little confused at that time. I remember, I thought to myself, what is this? Is this a real person? And I asked my dad, I was like, is this a real person? He's like, no, this is a sculpture. And I said, really? Did he sculpt it from clay or something? He said, no, he did this from a rock. He did this from a rock called marble. And I was just like, how is that even possible? How can you do that from a marble? And then when he said afterwards, even put me in more of an awe, is he said, you know, it's actually bigger than our ceilings. It's taller than our ceilings.
Wow.
And we had tall ceilings back in Ukraine. And obviously, it's nowhere near as tall as David. I mean, when I saw the Statue of David in October, I was speechless. I mean, I couldn't speak afterwards. But that time when I was a kid, he said that. And I was just like, you know, when you're so impressed with something, you really have nothing to say. I mean, there's nothing that can be said, really. And I was just like, it was overwhelming. It was beyond me what he just told me when he showed me Statue of David in the book. And I mean, afterwards, I think I started drawing, you know, cartoon characters. My favorite cartoon as a kid was Tom and Jerry. So I was trying to do that and different things like that. But that experience, when my dad showed me that image of the Statue of David when I was a child, really stuck with me. And as I grew older and I kind of had art lessons you know, practiced art in school and things like that, I kept looking at Michelangelo, and I was just really amazed. And I actually had a professor in college that told me an interesting thing, because I asked him a legitimate question that not many people really ask. And I asked him, how do you know if an artwork is great? What makes an artwork a great work of art? And it's a very difficult thing to answer, because there is no right answer to a question like that. But he told me something that kind of made me agree with him in some way. He said, a truly great work of art, when you see it the first time, you know, you're impressed with it. But as you get back to it, you see something different, and it grows with you, and it keeps growing with you your entire life. And you can always come back to it and look at it. It doesn't get old. You know, it's not like you've heard some obnoxious song by, you know, and you don't want to listen to it anymore. No, this is something that you see this work, and you come back to it, and you always get something from it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it's been with Michelangelo's work all throughout my life. And I mean, that was the beginning of me really seeing what art can do. And that was the prime example of what art can do, because after I saw the Statue of David in real life, I was certain that that's, in my mind, that's the greatest work of art that's ever been created in all of humanity. It's just, it's so profound in so many different ways that it's just overwhelming. I highly recommend you go to Florence one time or sometime, you know, whenever you're able to, and you visit the Statue of David and spend some time with it. There's also other sculptures by Michelangelo in there. Mm-hmm. There's one of his Pietas, Pieta Palestrina, and his unfinished slaves that he meant to do for the Pope Julius' tomb, the original design of Pope Julius' tomb. And those are also very impressive, just like anything that God demanded. They're phenomenal. But the Statue of David is just, it's really the most impressive work of art that I've ever seen in my entire life. And, you know, I've been to the Louvre, I've been to Musée d'Orsay, I've been to the Metropolitan Museum, I've been to quite a few museums, you know, throughout, but I've never seen anything like that work ever. I mean, it's just, it's something that's just, I think something like that is not really a masterpiece anymore. I mean, you could say a work is a masterpiece, but when you look at a work like that, it's like godly. It's like a godliness. There's a sense of divinity in it when you look at it. I actually felt a euphoria when looking at it. It was as though, I believe I had a headache before I went to go look at the Statue of David, because I was walking around Florence and I was just, you know, had an early day and just, it was a little stressful. But when I went there and I saw the Statue of David and all the other sculptures, all my pain went away. I just felt full euphoria when I was looking at it. It was like the most incredible thing I've ever experienced. It was really something else.
Yeah, I'm looking at the slave ones right now, and there's the David at the top. Earlier in the conversation, you were talking about the texture, and I see this image of the thigh, and you can almost see. It's like when you look at the back of your hand and you see all of like the little cells or whatever that form your skin, the texture of your skin. You're looking at this leg, and it's just like, how the hell did he like chisel all those little, like all that texture in there? That's insane. But I definitely will get there one day here and go through that experience, because I want to experience what you're experiencing. I think it's really beautiful because in your story specifically, because you know, so many years ago as a little kid, you have this connection with David. In this wonder, you know, which most likely was the spark for your art. And then fast forward, you know, a couple decades and boom, now you're standing in this moment where you're actually physically
there. It was overwhelming. It was really an overwhelming experience. I don't remember any time in my life that I've ever felt that way, standing in front of a work of art. It was a magical experience for me when I saw it. And also I was with a group of people there, and I had to give a little history about David. I was kind of doing a little tour guide there, you know, because I was with a group of people that went to Italy. But before I came in and I saw it from afar, I had to give a little story of how Michelangelo got the commission of David. But I just couldn't wait to get close to it and really walk around it. And by the way, I could send you later on the images that I took with my smartphone of David from different angles. And I think I posted it in my group, but I could send you the higher images so you can really zoom in and see some of the details on it.
Awesome.
They're not like super detailed images because it's a smartphone, but it's a 16.7 megapixel smartphone, so you could see quite a bit. And if you want, I can email you those after. Yeah,
that's awesome. Now, have you ever played with sculpture?
Yeah, actually, I have. The first sculpture I've done was in high school ceramics class, because I had to take ceramics and everybody else was doing pots and boxes and things like that. And I asked my teacher, can I just do sculpture, because that's something I'm more interested in? And she said, sure. So I actually did a few sculptures. The very first sculptures I did, I actually threw away a long time ago. And I regret that. Another project I did was—it's very ambitious for the time—is take the best photographs from online that I can get, and try to replicate David. And I was doing a little replica of David, trying a copy, not a replica. I wasn't that good, and I'm still not really a sculptor. But I did an okay job for the time. And when I finished it, it went into the kiln to be burned, but it cracked because there was air inside, and I didn't have that much knowledge of the medium of ceramics. So it just broke off. And I don't think I have a picture anymore, but you know, it was an interesting experience trying to copy a David in the miniature. But I do want to get into sculpture someday. Right now I'm just working on creating a body of work of paintings that I want to possibly have a show in some years from now. But I do want to get into sculpture because I really love looking at sculptures, 3D traditional work. It really elevates me very high when I look at great works of art that are three-dimensional. I actually saw in Rome, I saw the Bernini masterpiece, which is the at the Church of Santa Maria della Vittoria, or mm-hmm. the Bernaro Chapel, which is St. Teresa in Ecstasy.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was also a very, very impressive work of art. Really enjoyed it. I highly recommend. Have you ever been to Italy, by the way?
No, not yet.
Oh, I highly recommend you go and you just explore different cities in Italy. Specifically Venice, Florence, and Rome. But my favorite from all of them was probably Florence. When you walk around Florence, like the architecture there is the same as during the Renaissance in the old Florence. So you feel like you're walking around and you might see like Leonardo walking by or Michelangelo. You feel like you're in that era.
Yeah.
You know, the 1500s, you're in that, it's the same architecture.
Wow.
It's just so amazing. I mean, in general, Italy is just such a beautiful country. So much history, so much culture, and the art is, it's just, there are no words to describe it. So highly recommend, and anybody listening to this, highly recommend to visit Italy because it's really it's the motherland of art, in my opinion.
That's beautiful, man. Yeah, I'm definitely going to get there. I went to Portugal last year, and when I got to Portugal, I realized, oh my gosh, like once you're in Portugal, you can almost go anywhere. And it's like, it's like in the United States, maybe like going maybe a state or two away, which isn't a short trip, but it isn't like the end of the world trip either, right? But from going from the US to Italy or something like that is a big deal. But once you're in Europe, it's like, oh no, it's really not a big deal. I like to try to get back once a year and explore different things. So Italy definitely is a place I want to be in. I feel like when I go, I'm going to go to Italy for some weird reason. And so I'm kind of excited to know what that is. I just don't know what it is yet. I know last year I was talking to a lady who owns a bed and breakfast in one of the little Italian towns, and she spends about half the year there and half the year in the United States. And she wanted to expand her business there and do something bigger. And she was thinking about creating like some type of amusement park or something. And we were encouraging her to consider expanding her bed and breakfast, but opening it up to artists. And then, because where it's located, I don't remember the name of the city, but where it's located, it's only like a drive to like these different major art hubs, like cities. And so, we'll see where that goes. But that is a project that I want to kind of keep encouraging her to really consider and put together. Because it'd be kind of nice to have a place you can go to as an artist and then travel to these different cities and experience this art. So, Eugene, if you're going to give an artist a word of encouragement or kind of point them in a direction, what message would you give to other artists?
Well, first off, I would say I think that if you're brave enough and courageous enough to do art and be expressing yourself and putting yourself out there, you got to first do something that you believe in. You have to really believe in what you're doing for whatever reason it is that you're doing it. Because if you don't believe in what you're doing, then most likely nothing is going to happen with it. You got to really find the reason why you want to do what you want to do, whether it's to produce, you know, some kind of profound messages, or even to create beautiful work that you think you want to just create beauty. You got to really believe in what you're doing. And another thing that I would say is, don't be afraid to try new things when you're doing art. Don't be afraid to experiment. Don't be, you know, even if you fail in the end, you're going to learn something from it. So it's not going to, if you don't want to leave something that you think is bad after you, you can always, you know, dispose of the work of art somehow, you know, burn it or whatever, but at least you're going to learn from doing something that might have been wrong of you to do compositionally or maybe color-wise. Really just go for it. If you have an idea, just do it, you know, and see what comes out of it. I have to say that, I also have done many works that I'm not that proud of. I mean, there's many trial and errors that I went through that, some of the things I did were just horrible, you know, but I tried doing something new and then I realized, okay, well, this doesn't work. So, okay, I'm not going to do that anymore. But until you really do it, you really don't know. I mean, you have to really go for it. So I would recommend try it. You know, if you think it might or might not work, try it, and then you'll see afterwards, and then you'll know. Because the way you really know is from experience, especially in the field of art.
That's awesome. My teacher used to say, make an intelligent mess. And that just kind of gave you the permission to give it a great, you know, to give it your best. But if you didn't get it right, that was okay. Cause at least you learned something. It was an intelligent mess.
But you know, I'll say one interesting thing is that, the Venetian painters, great Venetian painters, Titian, Veronese, and Tintoretto, I think Tintoretto was probably, out of all three, the greatest composer. And he just went crazy sometimes. Like, he just broke the rules. like for instance, The Last Supper that he did, which is very kind of awkward composition, but it's actually brilliant because you see the table from kind of like a upper view angle of Jesus and his disciples. And then there's spirits flying around, and the perspective is wrong. It's not perfect perspective. And he just decided to try something that's never been done before. And there are intentional errors in that painting, but it's actually a very profound and very unique painting in itself. And now it's hailed as a masterpiece. But you know, this is an extreme example of somebody that just went for it and decided to do something completely different that's never been done before. And something great came of it. So, you know, that's like the ultimate example of somebody doing that.
That's awesome. I'm actually looking it up right now. I don't know where that one came from, but that's not it. Let me see here. Well, I guess I'll look. Oh, here it is. Oh, no, that's a Picasso. Very cool, man. So I'm going to ask you, before we wrap up here, and you can give people your contact information so they can get in touch with you. But before we do that, I want to ask you the most important question. Everybody knows what that question is, but we got to ask you anyways. Eugene, what is it that you love to eat?
Well, that's a tough thing. I mean, I like anything that tastes good. That's the easy answer. Really, I really love sushi. I love pizza. I love kebab. Good kebab places. There's some good ones in LA. In terms of, you know, sweet food, I really love, you know, Japanese fried ice cream. That's really tasty.
Sounds nice.
I don't know. Have you ever had that?
I've never had Japanese fried ice cream, but I've had Mexican fried ice cream. And
Oh, really? I've never had that.
And I don't know if it's the same thing or not, but Mexican fried ice cream is freaking awesome.
Oh, really? Wow. I have to try that.
What's the Japanese fried ice cream like? Like, how would you describe that?
Well, there's actually a place not far from me that I sometimes go to. It's called Shiki Sushi. And there's actually celebrities that go there. I've seen William Shatner there 3 times.
Really?
And yeah, he sometimes goes there. And they have this really tasty fried ice cream. And I usually get green tea flavor. And okay. What they do is they have this sweet dough that they put it around and they fry it. And then they pour it with liquid chocolate around it. And there's kiwis also around it, and like a few different fruits. And it's just really very tasty, very tasty.
Nice, nice. That's very similar to the Mexican fried ice cream where I remember the first time I ever had it, it was ice cream rolled in cornflakes. And and then they deep fried that. But everywhere else, it's kind of like a dough. It's almost like a dumpling in a sense. And when you cut it open, there's ice cream in the inside, and then, you know, there's a chocolate on top of it and stuff like that.
Well, you know, I love Mexican food as well. If you know any good restaurants in LA that have that, let me know. I'll check it out.
Yeah. Probably about 80% of the Mexican restaurants I've gone to have it. So it's pretty like a pretty common thing. It's funny earlier, before we got on, I had some soup and I've been putting this, ginger, this mix of, spices in there of ginger and garlic and cayenne pepper. But I take a scoop out with my hand and I put it in there, but it's hot because of the cayenne pepper. And now my eye is swelling up because I guess, I don't know if I didn't wash my hands good enough or whatever, but at the end here, I rubbed my eyes and now my eyeball's like on fire.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, I'm going to go wash my eye out when we're done here.
Probably some cool water on that eye.
Yeah. You know, I'll go blind for the sake of art. Yes. Yeah. But now you're originally from the Ukraine, correct?
Yeah, I was born in Ukraine.
And then how old were you when you came to Malta, California?
7.
Oh, wow. Really? Shoot, man. That's cool. And have you been back to the Ukraine?
No, it's actually not a very good situation there right now.
Okay.
There's civil unrest and really just, it's a bad place to be at the moment.
I gotcha.
Probably, as bad as any of the,
the
intense war zone in the world. So yeah, it's a bad place to be right now.
Understood. Is there like a cuisine or a food from your, from Ukraine that you enjoy?
There's some good Russian food that I like.
Mm.
Ukrainian and Russian food are very similar.
Mm-hmm.
In general, they're almost the same, a little difference, but, there's dumplings, but they're kind of like Chinese dumplings, but they're Russian dumplings.
Hmm.
There's also this really good soup. It's called solyanka, and it's actually kind of it has a lot of cholesterol because it's made with bacon and it's made with different deli meats. And there's olives.
So good.
There's lemon, and it's very tasty, but it's really filling. So just giving a heads up to anyone that wants to try it, but it's very good. You know, I recommend everybody tries it. If they're not vegetarian, anybody gives it a try at least once, I think they'll like it. But there's a lot of things that Russian cuisine, has. I've been to many Russian restaurants and, they have some good food, I think. It's just that I always eat it all the time. So with me, I prefer to eat something different,
mm-hmm.
That I don't eat all the time. Like I would say, I really like sushi and like really good albacore sushi,
Albacore sushi? Like what's that?
Albacore tuna.
Oh, albacore. Okay, gotcha. Yeah, that sounds good, man. Oh, sushi. I want some sushi now. So, Eugene, if people want to find out more about you, your work, how can they find you?
Well, I have an art website. It's cooperart.com. It's spelled cooperart.com. Everybody's welcome to go there and check out what's on there. Also, some months ago in 2017, I got an honorable mention for my painting about the Armenian Genocide. And it's been published in Artist Magazine. It's Artist Magazine March issue of 2018. And I'm actually very proud that it was chosen, because it was chosen by one of my favorite living artists, which is David Kasson. And he gave me an honorable mention. And really,
nice.
Really proud that he liked my work, because I love his work. I think what he's doing is really, really admirable and very great work. But the reason why I'm saying this is because somebody read that magazine and they saw my work there,
mm-hmm.
and they actually found me on Facebook and they asked me about it. And I was very glad to reply and tell them what this painting is about. Because the reason why I did it is because I'm doing it to bring awareness to this subject matter that's kind of a little controversial, since even America hasn't really recognized it. But I was very glad to answer them. So, I have an art page on Facebook. People can contact me there. More than glad to answer anything, any kind of questions they have. Those are the two ways they can reach out.
Awesome. Awesome. And then what I'll do is I'll take the links to those pages, your website and your Facebook page, and add them to the show notes so that people can just click on it and link over. There was something I wanted to ask you. I saw in a video where you had a wall. In front of this wall, you had a bunch of little sculptures, which now make total sense why you have all those little sculptures. But you had about 499,605 certificates on that wall.
No, not quite that many.
No, not that many. How many do you have up there?
Well, I don't know. I would say about 30.
Wow.
Maybe a little, give or take.
And what are they like generally? Are they all art certificates? Like what are they? Or are they awards or?
Yeah. Some of them, well, a lot of them are art awards that I got. There's one certificate that's a certificate of recommendation from the mayor of Beverly Hills.
Oh, wow.
Because I had a show in Beverly Hills in 2011, so I got that certificate.
Nice.
And there's actually 9 Addy Awards, which is 9 design awards that I got.
Oh, wow.
And the rest are awards from different competitions. I just keep applying to a lot of different competitions,
mm-hmm.
Just to kind of get myself out there. And also to, since I've been doing mostly social commentary type of work, I want to, you know, get the messages out there. So it's for a variety of reasons that I apply to these competitions. But whenever, you know, a subject that I'm very passionate about and serious about that I want to let people know about, I try to apply it to different places so more people know about it, such as, you know, the Armenian Genocide painting that I did. And, you know, I think that I'm really happy if more people know about these things that I'm painting. By the way, I didn't paint the Armenian Genocide painting or the Holocaust painting to make money. I'm not planning on making any profit from them. I'm not planning on selling any prints. I'm not planning on selling the originals. If I would rather just donate both of them to good causes like museums of Holocaust or Museum of Genocide. These are more ideologically, you know, fueled projects.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you know, it's not very commercial because not many people are going to want to hang in their living room a picture of a genocide, you know. So it's not something that most people would want to look at every day when they wake up or when they go to a room, you know. But
yeah,
these things I do because, you know, I really do believe in the messages and the history, and I want more people to know about them.
Awesome. Awesome. That sounds like a brilliant strategy to enter those shows and contests to get the word out. Very, very cool, man.
Hi, my name is Delisha van Deventer. I am from Gauteng in South Africa. I am a landscape artist. I'm currently doing the Core 80 at the Academy of Composition. This course has had an invaluable impact in my life. Into what my art should look like and how I should be presenting my art to the art world. When I was challenged with what it means to interpret and read and analyze the old masters, I found myself starting to read their thoughts and the way they put certain objects in strategic places, the way their bodies would line up and lean in a certain direction, and why certain elements were lined up. All of these were so beautifully composed and strategically designed to fit into a story so that when the viewer looks at the painting, they are mesmerized and the energy of the piece draws them into the story. As an artist, I will be applying these principles so that my art can have that wow factor and go to another level. I highly recommend this course to all aspiring artists, especially amateur artists, accomplished artists, and as well as gallery owners.
In just 30 days, the Core 80 Experience teaches you to decode the intentional design underneath great masterpieces. Through video lessons, assignments, and feedback, you learn to recognize the underlining structures like thrust maps, echoes, and gamuts that give master compositions substance and gravitas. Knowing how master artists and illustrators compose their artwork unlocks